Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Field Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today, finally giving you a break from the Andrew solo episodes. I'm not sure exactly when this is airing, but there's been a lot of just me on the mic. We're going to mix that up for your sanity here. And joined by Joe Scholarud, who's the co-founder of AdAdvance.com. Joel joins us from Duluth, Minnesota. He is a native there, started an e-commerce business, scaled it up, learned the ropes of paid advertising, and ended up building a technologically enabled advertising company online. We cover Amazon, advertising on Amazon, but specifically how Amazon is becoming a pretty big competitor to Meta and to Facebook, and all the ways you can use their advertising platform and data insights to advertise off-platform, not just with direct listings. We talk about Gemini Deep Research, some of its competitive advantages, and why he actually enjoyed the due diligence process when he was recently sold the business to Permanent Equity. Anyway, great discussion. Really enjoyed it. So I'm going to be diving into that as well as our ongoing Forge What Matters segment right after this. I'm excited to geek out with you on the advertising front. At the top, like I mentioned, you know, one of the co-founders of AdAdvance. I'd love to start talking about Amazon as a digital advertising network. Like I think, and I myself very much think this way, I don't have a deep background in paid, well, who am I joking? I don't have any background in paid advertising. And so people that are deep in this world probably isn't a surprise for, but people that are maybe more on the layman's terms or aren't as deep as you are, Amazon is becoming a pretty big digital advertising network, not just selling for Amazon, but in its own right, even to be able to reach audiences off the platform. So a couple of things. Could you talk about the ways that you can advertise on with Amazon's platform that people may not be thinking about, what those opportunities are, and then also maybe give us a sense of how big it is compared to the big, you know, the ones you immediately think of, Meta and Google, in terms of ad spend size, growth rates, et cetera.
Yeah. So I think this is a key point, and I love that we're starting here. If you look at earning reports from Amazon and you dig into the data, there's two major profit centers for Amazon, and neither one of those two is actually e-commerce sales. So Amazon's been able to build out this amazing cloud infrastructure. So AWS is one of the major profit drivers for Amazon, but the other one is actually advertising. And if you stripped out those two, Amazon in many quarters would not have been profitable. And so what Amazon has done is everybody looks at them as the e-commerce company, but they're kind of incognito, this big e-commerce data company that you can use for advertising. And so, you know, if I compare the different types of advertising data that I can get between the different channels, like if I go with Google, I can get search history. And from there, I can usually get buyer intent. If I take a step back for like Meta, I can see what you're interested in and find some contextually relevant stuff that I can target. But it's pretty far away from the purchase in many instances. Whereas compared to Amazon or other retailers too, they have the actual purchase history. And so they know exactly what you purchase, what you enjoy. That's where you're spending your money. And so in terms of advertising intent data, this is super valuable. And so there's multiple ways that you can use this information both on the platform, but also off the platform too.
What does the off-platform targeting look like? And maybe you could speak to targeting, but then also what other platforms can you buy ad inventory or reach people outside of Amazon.com?
Yeah. So we'll start with ad placements because I think that's the easiest to understand. Like, where do these ads actually show up? I'm sure everybody's familiar with the ads that are on the platform. So I do a search on Amazon. They show up for my sponsored ads. I'm on the product detail page. I see a bunch of ads there. They all show the little sponsored icon. But what a lot of people don't see is, one, Amazon is now this major media company. So Prime Video now runs ads. Amazon has Thursday Night Football, women's basketball, NASCAR will be coming. They're buying all these different sports rights and just building up on the video side. Amazon owns Twitch, which is a social media platform primarily geared around gaming, but that's expanded quite a bit. They have Wondery, which is podcasts. But then the other major piece is that Amazon has this big distribution network where, like Google, their ads can show up on pages throughout the web. So if I go to weather.com or your favorite news site or, you know, a blogger platform, they can run Amazon's ads too. And so that's where these ads can show up. And what's really valuable is you have all these unique spots where you can show the ads, but then you have this really solid targeting data because you can utilize the previous purchase history to make sure that you're showing your ads to the right people. And then layer it in with other stuff that they've got to layer it into at the right time, at the right place. The platform as a whole is extremely powerful.
How much work is it to tap? I mean, you mentioned Twitch, you mentioned Prime Video, you mentioned, you know, kind of like a Google Display Network style thing on blogger sites, things like that. I'm thinking of, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 different ad formats and kind of in textual environments, things like that. Is there how complex is it to be able to, as someone who doesn't have a massive team, to be able to take advantage of all these without insane amounts of work customizing your ad formats to reach in all these different mediums? Or does Amazon have a pretty good way for saying, hey, upload one video, we'll scale it, we'll format it for all these things, upload. What's the dynamic creation ability and how much work does it take to leverage all these different tentacles that reach out?
Yeah. So there's three major platforms, I would say, within the Amazon Ads ecosystem. So one is the advertising console, which is where you would typically run your sponsored ads, which a lot of e-commerce sellers are going to be familiar with. This is where I do my keyword, my product targeting, and I pick the different products I want to run. The other one that taps into a lot of these other ecosystems is called Amazon's DSP, or demand side platform. And this is just the structure around, all right, here's the audience I want to target, here's the ad I want to show, and here's the different locations that I want to show it on. In terms of usability, I'll say there's a lot of opportunity for improvement. So it can be very clunky. It's gotten a lot better over time. So in terms of, like, you know, if I sold on Amazon, and that's how I ended up getting into the space. So if I were in my previous shoes as an Amazon seller and trying to utilize Amazon's DSP, it would be a decent leap to do it. And so usually you want to find some experts or hire the right people on your team to do that. It can get really complex, but with that complexity, if you can utilize it in the right way, it can give you a huge advantage.
And what about relative size and growth of Meta and Facebook? I was listening to an interview you did previously. You were talking about this. Amazon, I think you said the ad side of their business is growing 20% per year. How does that compare to Facebook and Meta? And then also, how does it compare in terms of just total spend? You may or may not have the numbers there, but how big is Amazon relative to those other two?
Yeah. So Amazon is number three. But if we look at overall growth, in terms of, like, search for Google, that's definitely flattened off a bit. Same thing for Meta too. There's always new social platforms. Like, TikTok advertising has been expanding quite a bit, assuming that the platform stays around. But in terms of retail media, like, it's not just Amazon that's looking to tap into this too. Like, all the different retailers are looking for ways that they can utilize their data for advertising. And so, you know, like, Walmart is investing heavily into their ads business. So if you look at the margins that they sell for any individual product, it's very low margins. But if you look at the margins from advertising, it's huge. And so there is a huge push from all the retailers that are typically in this very low margin business. They're seeing what Amazon can do. They're seeing the profits that are generated. And they're saying, how do we tap into this? So there's different other platforms like Criteo or Epsilon, which brings in all this other retailer data. And you can run ads off of those. There's other DSPs like the Trade Desk there. I can pull in Walmart's data and then also use that for targeting, just like I can do with Amazon's DSP. And so I think a big shift or a big change or something to be aware of is all these retailers are really looking for how they can use this data. And as an e-commerce seller, there's a lot of ways that we can put that to work.
One of the theses I have, and I talked about this in my 2025 predictions episode, is you look at Google, and I'm seeing in my own behavior and the behavior of a lot of people I've talked to, they are just not using Google as their Google use has just fallen off a cliff with the emergence of LLMs to get information and things like that. And I can't see how that doesn't materially impact their business. And I believe their percentage of their market share of search fell below 90% for the first time ever the last, you know, month or two. Anyway, I have this, relatively speaking, wildly uninformed opinion. I am not in the Google search game or the paid ad scam like you are. And that's, of course, what Google kind of runs on. What are you seeing there? Like, is that something you worry about? Do you see Google, do you see that as a realistic threat and a concern for them and people advertising on AdWords and the Google Display Network?
Yes. Yes, I definitely do. So I have also seen it with my own browsing behavior. So I'm not doing Google searches as much. I'm going to my AI chat agents, whether it's ChatGPT, Claude, or Gemini. They all three have their pros and cons. They're all good at different things. And so I see search continually going down. Another key thing that I see is I go to less websites overall, because through these agents, I can just get the answers right away. And so not only is Google search, I think the traffic's going to continue to go down, but the other key piece of like Google's business is their display ad network, where if I visit less websites that show the ads too, that's another hit. And so, and this impacts the overall ad industry as a whole. And so what's going to be really interesting as we go and we get further into like AI agents is there going to be a paid component? Or is it more of a monthly subscription model? Like, you could incorporate ads directly into the LLMs. And I think there is a huge potential for people who can do that and do that well. Can you do that to maintain the authenticity of the LLM? I don't know. There's a ton of unknowns. Like, how do you target these items? Like, I can't just do typical keyword-based targeting, like if it's in a conversation. And another key thing from the e-commerce side that I'm really interested in is as these get better and better and we start to get AI agents, like how I picture an AI agent is it gets to know my shopping preferences. It gets to know me really well. And I've used like Google's deep research or Gemini's deep research to look at different products and compare them and then tell me which one I should get. As more and more go directly through these agents, do I go to Amazon.com as much? I don't know. And so I can see a lot more traffic being funneled through these different AI agents in the future, which can completely shift advertising, can completely shift how we do our purchases, how we research products. So yeah, it's going to be a very dynamic year, I think.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Alex from poppyscrubs.com, where they sell, not shockingly, medical scrubs. And I actually met Alex when he was running global e-commerce for Specialized, and he since then started poppyscrubs.com with his co-founder. And here's what he had to say about being a part of e-commerce Fuel, our vetted community for 7 and 8-figure store owners.
Just the sheer breadth of experience that all the members have. So whenever I'm searching for another partner, another piece of software, or another like warehouse or fulfillment partner, ECF provides a really great pool of experts who've tried a lot of the popular options out there, can help steer depending on the goals of my business. So I don't waste time, you know, shopping or trying software or agencies that may not be right for me.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. It's interesting. I say this next part as somebody who runs a subscription-based, like paywalled community, and so I'm very unbiased. I'm very biased on this position. But I actually like the idea of having the primary place people go is be LLMs that are subscription and paid for. Obviously, there's a free version, but Google's, you know, at least from the very early days, maybe not out of the gates, but very early, was always free and monetized with ads. Whereas people are, even if it's not the majority, most power users are getting used to paying for these LLM models, right? Like, you know, ChatGPT, Claude, these things you're paying $20, $30 or even $200 a month for some of them. And I don't know, when I think about a world in the future, I like the idea of having a paid model that doesn't have to monetize on ads, can give you better results, can think about your experience first, and you maybe pay a little more for it as opposed to the ad-supported model. Yeah, that's a world that I'm more excited to live in versus Google. Everything is, you know, you got to scroll down, you know, for 30 seconds before you get to your first organic listing.
Yeah. From a personal standpoint, I totally agree. It's going to be very interesting to see from a consumer standpoint if that's actually what happens. You know, because if I look at like Netflix going to an advertising model, in the breakdown on people who are willing to pay less but still get ads, that's the majority of the subscribers. And so I'm used to paying the monthly fees right now. And I don't see a very fluid way on how they can incorporate ads in right now. But at the same time, do I end up just picking up the free ones in the future? I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see where people lean on this, just based off of other platforms rolling out ads, but then having the no ad model. Most people do opt for ads if it costs less.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a real, depends on who you are, how much disposable income you have, how much time you spend online. I saw someone today make a tweet, and I have no idea if this is actually factually, I'm just spreading, you know, wanton rumors here, so take it for what it's worth. They said that Jeep, the company behind Jeep, is starting to put ads on the digital displays for the vehicles to in order to make more money. And this person was just like, listen, if that happens on my car, I'm getting rid of both of my Jeeps today. And I kind of agree a little bit. Like, I'd be pissed if on my Toyota, a bunch of ads started rolling in. It seems like a slightly sacred, not sacred, but I just would be very invasive. Anyway, sorry, I'm ranting here. You're becoming my therapist. Gemini, you said you've used Gemini, deep research there. I have a lot of experience with Claude and Anthropic, a lot of experience with ChatGPT, zero experience with Gemini outside of the in-browser Google search kind of results they show you. How have you liked Gemini, and what do you feel like its competitive advantages over the other models?
Yeah, so starting with the other two, Claude is my go-to for any coding-related items. So if I want to write a macro for a spreadsheet, or if I got to tune up some code, that's my go-to. ChatGPT, awesome for my general questions. Where I really like Gemini is they've built it kind of around the search model. And so it's really good for pulling like up-to-date information. So Gemini with deep research, it will go through and I can type in and I could say, all right, compare these three types of hiking boots for me, or find the best ones. Here's what I value. And it'll go through, it'll find 80 different websites and it'll pull all that information together, put in this nice research summary, compare all the pros and cons, and then give me a recommendation on what I should purchase. So any like deep research where I need to pull information directly from the web and I need it to be current, that's where I tend to lean towards Gemini. I know the other ones are getting a lot better at that too, but that's typically my breakdown, like coding, Claude, day-to-day questions, ChatGPT, anything needing like recent information, I go to Gemini.
Have you used, I know ChatGPT, I'm not sure what the plan name is, but they have a $200 per month tier, which also includes kind of their version of deep research, right? Have you experimented with or used that at all?
I have not. I've heard the model is really good. And it's funny with how expressive these models are getting when you can see the thought process. I don't know. It's amazing the creativity that these things can bring. Like, it's even getting to the weird spot where like I pulled up Gemini on my phone and there's like the live conversation. And my kids were doing some homework. And so I was like, this is going to be kind of fun. Like, hey, just ask Gemini. And they got done. And then my daughter, who's six, at the very end, she's like, yeah, he was nice. And I was like, okay, well, that was a computer. Yeah. But it's so fluid. It's wild.
It's amazing. I had same thing. My daughter was preparing for a debate with me about like the merits of wind energy over nuclear energy. And I had her use the voice version of ChatGPT to do a mock debate and then tell her where her arguments were strong, where they were weak, and how she could strengthen them for the real debate. And it's so funny how we acclimate as humans. Like 3 years ago, ChatGPT came out a little over 2 years ago, Two and a half years ago, if I had seen that, my head would have exploded, right? Like, and now it's just normal for her. This is just the world works. And it's pretty phenomenal how fast stuff has come. And probably it's going to be pretty wild to see what happens in the next 3 years. Back to advertising, though, you have your hands in a lot of different things. And we'll talk about AdAdvance here and kind of who you're a great fit for in just a minute. But given your kind of broad perspective and experience across a lot of different platforms and mediums, what's changed in the last year to be effective? And that's a very broad question, but maybe if you could point to the one or two big things, either in general or one or two things by the big platforms, Google, Amazon, and Meta, that people need to adjust if they haven't already to continue to have paid be a good strategy for them.
Yeah. I would say one thing that I consistently see as an e-commerce seller, and this is a piece that I originally did not value as an e-commerce seller myself, is the power of brand in creating a lineup of products that can drive not just that initial purchase, but repeat purchases after the fact. And the key reason for that, if we look at the ad industry as a whole, when I started selling a decade ago, like cost per click was very cheap. I'd complain about a 5% ACOS or a 20X ROAS, and it was very easy. But competition has continually pushed up and up the costs. And so there is this implicit tax that you have to pay to just get your product shown. Like Amazon has saturated their search listings with advertising. I don't think they can add any more without really degrading the user experience. And that eats away margin. And so what I've continually seen is the profit margin on that first sale is continually getting degraded. But what I've also seen is the brands that have the most success are those that are able to drive repeat purchases after the fact. So can I increase my lifetime value after I spend all that money to get my first new-to-brand customer? And that's where it gets really fun on the advertising side, because we find these brands that have really strong cross-sell potential or repeat purchase potential. So, you know, I look at like health and wellness, beauty, supplements, like apparel, where we have a strong brand presence and they're coming back and buying again and again. And so if you can drive your advertising dollars, not to make profit on that first sale, but to get that new to brand customer and then focus your efforts on how I drive those repeat sales over time, getting that recurring income is where the profits are. And that's where the brands that are really going to succeed in the long term are going to thrive, because they're not just building that initial sale. I'm not competing on price. I'm not just competing on product features. I'm building up that brand loyalty. I'm building up that recurring income that keeps coming back over time.
So my next question was going to be, what have you seen in terms of like kind of average ROAS or whatever metric you want to use? What I'm reading into it based on your last answer is that probably table stakes for starting out, you're seeing a lot of brands probably at a break even or even a slight loss on the ROAS, having to make it up on the back end. Is that correct? And what percentage of campaigns and stores are you actually able to see being able to be for sale profitable with ROAS, depending on their margin, of course, but maybe being, you know, 2, 3, 4X?
Totally depends on the brand. So if I look at like electronics, which are usually a lot lower profit margin, my ROAS is going to be a lot better just because people can't bid up to, they don't have as much margin to bid up. But what we see is that as everything kind of equilibrates between, the cost per click is continually being bid up to that $0 profit margin. And as other things come into play, like, you know, increasing fees to sell on these platforms. Now, with all the updates on tariffs and wherever that goes, like, you know, these are other costs that we potentially either have to increase prices or absorb that into the profit margin. And so what I continually see is that the cost of advertising on these platforms is being bid up. And so in some instances, like supplements, my ROAS can be very low on that initial purchase, because there is so much value in driving that new to brand customer. For something that's very low margin, like I would just say like general electronics, like that ROAS might be a lot higher. But really what it comes down to is, what is that extra margin that's available? And those that are succeeding are not looking at that initial purchase. They're looking at the entire lifetime value. And Amazon's rolled out a lot of tools on this, and some of it's self-serving, because if we can see the total lifetime value, we can bid more on that initial purchase, which drives up advertising revenue. But those that can do it better, that can reach those new to brand customers better, that can drive those repeat purchases better, that can build up their brand loyalty, those are the ones that with really staying power and that are able to preserve the profit margin overall.
So what I'm hearing from you is, if you were starting a new brand in 2025, you had better have a good repeat purchase thesis / product offering, other or you're screwed. And if you have a brand that doesn't have that, figure out how to get one quickly.
Yes. Yep. I would totally agree. It's, you know, 10 years ago, I could go onto Alibaba and find a general product and I could sell it on Amazon and it would do just fine. Those days are gone. And so now it's looking at the, starting with the brand and then looking at the product lineup and being like, okay, how do I drive the repeat purchases here? How do I build up the brand loyalty? And then the ad strategy comes around that. And so, you know, our ideal customers are those that have that solid brand, that have that solid product lineup where once that initial purchase comes in, now here's the next one that we promote. We can have a full customer journey. Here's the brand story. Now we get down to the sponsored ads and we get to that initial purchase. We can track lifetime value, we can track new to brand, cost per acquisition, what's the best gateway product, all that good stuff. And that's where you can really set yourself apart. But without that, if you're just competing on price or product features, it's going to be a race to that very slim profit margin.
You sold recently to Permanent Equity. If people aren't familiar with them, they're a private equity company that takes a very, as the name implies, a very long-term approach to holding and tends to invest in companies that have large moats. For example, they invested recently or purchased recently a company that makes amusement park rides like roller coasters, which, you know, tons of moat, tons of IP, not a lot of people doing this. And I believe I was listening again in that interview again, you mentioned you sold partially because you want to take money off the table. Like a lot of entrepreneurs, you build something up, you got so much of your net worth tied in there, makes a lot of sense. What was it that made AdAdvance a great option for Permanent Equity? You know, with all due respect, like there's a lot of e-commerce stores, there's a lot of ad agencies out there. And I wouldn't say that any of those have particularly huge moats, but you obviously built something that was very attractive to them. And I think probably speaks to either a way you built it or something interesting you did. So what was it? How have you been able to build an advertising agency that was attractive enough to this company that tends to be very selective that they made them want to buy you?
There's two different ways that you can go about building an agency. And so the traditional model is I'm going to find some people who know the space. I'm going to hire them. We're going to do everything manually. We're going to provide really good customer service and we're going to build that up over time. And then I try to scale that. And then I may bring in some software or tech to try to make life easier. But it's really built around, I'm going to bring in people. It's going to be a manual process and we're going to go from the start. Our approach was a little bit different, and maybe just because we didn't know any better. I'm not a traditional marketing guy. I haven't built an agency before. And this agency got started out of necessity for me as a seller where I didn't have solid tools to run my own ads. And so as a chemical engineering nerd, I started to build up my own tools to help do that. And from there, partnered up with my co-founder, and we spent 2 years focusing on the tech and the process and the software before we actually started to scale up in terms of account management. Like Matt and I, my co-founder Matt and I, we were the account managers and we wanted to get the software and the tech and the process up to a point where now when we scaled and we brought people in, we knew that they'd be getting a really solid experience. We knew that the tech and the background, like that was our moat, is all the work that's gone into that and the continual progress that we've had. The space is getting more and more and more complex. And there's more and more data that's available. It was very easy when I started. It felt very complicated. Just the scale that you can go from upper funnel all the way down. And now there's this Amazon Marketing Cloud with data clean rooms. And we have machine learning that optimizes by the hour. Because if you click an ad at 7 p.m. versus 7 a.m., the likelihood that you purchase changes significantly. So all that stuff coming together, what the tech allows us to do is then have our people really focus on the strategic aspects and focus on those things that people do best. And so what we try to do is our moat is built around having people what they do best, having the tech do everything that the tech should do, and then continually having this quick moving platform. And the in-office work kind of ties into that, where everything that we do is built around how do we do it as quickly as possible? How do we do it at scale? And how do we make sure that we give a consistent approach for every client that we have? And so I think it was those pieces where they saw the scale, they saw the process, and then they saw the team culture too, where we try to do everything very systematically. Culture is extremely huge for us too when you're in a people-driven business. So I think it was all those pieces together. And it didn't hurt that the entire space is growing significantly too. So we definitely had the market tailwinds in our favor.
So you've got a lot of proprietary tech behind the scenes that helps you. Thanks for diving into that. I think it's a very unusual, unique way to build, especially in the agency business. And one thing that I thought was interesting too, when you mentioned you were going through the due diligence process for the transaction, a lot of people hate that, justifiably so. It's a huge pain. But you mentioned too that you were also excited because it was this amazing chance to find out where the weaknesses in your business were from people who had a lot of reps doing this. And I thought that was such a cool approach and perspective on that process.
Yeah, I love that because you create a business you can be really good at things. I'm good at the advertising side. Am I good at HR and at, you know, filing sales taxes in different areas and reviewing different contracts? Like, those are the areas that would keep me up at night. It's like, what do I not know that I should know that is a potential risk to the business? Because I felt really confident in our core business. Like, we're doing well. We're continuing to grow. I can control this. I know this. But it was all those other pieces where that kept me up at night. It's like, okay, is there something I don't know that could completely derail us? And so from the due diligence standpoint, yep, you had to gather a lot of information, send that off. But unless you don't pick a right partner, like, they're going to be looking at the right things. Like, they're doing this to make sure that your business is in good standing. So I don't see how you could approach the process and be like, again, if you're picking the right partner, if they have an issue with something, like, I, as a business owner, should probably have an issue with it too. And so that's what I enjoyed with the due diligence process. I mean, working with somebody like Permanent Equity too, like, they're just a great group of individuals. They do all the due diligence in-house too. So this gave them an opportunity to really get to know our business inside and out. So I like how they do the due diligence process. But they were not the only people that we were working with. And every hole that they poked into this, it's like, okay, this is great, because I should definitely look into this. I want to fix it.
Joe from AdAdvance, the only co-founder or founder ever in the history of the universe to enjoy due diligence, but for good reason. It makes a lot of sense. Joe, talk. I mean, we've talked a bit about what you've built in your company, but shamelessly self-promotional here, and talk a little bit about AdAdvance. Obviously, you're an advertising agency, leverages tech, has people do what they do best, but what services you provide and who are you a great fit for, particularly maybe in terms of the type of e-commerce brand and how much they need to be thinking about spending per year to be a good fit?
Yeah. So for us, the ideal customers is those who are selling e-commerce products on different channels, whether it's Amazon, Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Costco. We support a ton of different retailers, or your own website. And so another key piece is you do not need to sell on Amazon or Walmart to use these advertising solutions. So I can use all the targeting methods. I can run ads offsite. I can send them back to your e-commerce store. So where we find the best fit is those that are established brands, that have a solid brand, that have those repeat purchase potential, where we can come in and from top to bottom, we can lay out that video brand ad all the way to track to the final purchase and trying to drive that customer loyalty throughout. So if you've got an established brand and you've got solid products, like, and you're selling on any one of these channels, would be a great fit for you.
Amazing. AdAdvance.com is the website. Joe, thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I'm going to hit you up if I'm ever in Duluth, and congrats on your recent sale to a great partner. Looking forward to keeping in touch and appreciate all the insights.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Andrew.
Forge What Matters. This fall, I was attending the Main Street Summit in Columbia, Missouri. It's something put on by Permanent Equity, Brent Beshore and his team, and found myself at the last night at the conference, sitting at a table with three other people. Had only planned to sit down for a couple minutes because I was tired. I was on my way to bed, and ended up not leaving for more than 2.5 hours later because we got into a phenomenal discussion about all sorts of things: politics, family, a business, God, whether he existed or not, what that looked like, how we should run our businesses, things, all of the good things in life. It's one of those discussions where you get done with it and you leave and you feel like you just had an incredibly delicious, filling, healthy, nutritious meal. And if I had to guess, I'm not sure, but if I had to guess, there was two conservatives, people that lean conservative, one moderate, and maybe one person that was a little more liberal. A few months later, I was talking to my team and we had to talk about someone in our community in the forums who, after multiple repeated warnings, had kind of made comments and accusations that were rude, condescending of people that weren't merited. And given we'd given warnings and had talked to him about this, we respectfully showed him the door. And it's not something common, thankfully, in our community that happens. But one of the things I appreciate most about running a community is being able to respectfully remove people who are toxic, who aren't reasonable, and save everyone else in the community from them. It's one of our jobs as a community moderator and as a gatekeeper. And I realized this year, why do I tell you these two stories, these two contrasting stories? I've realized over the last, you know, year-ish, year to 2 years, that one of the things I deeply respect, admire, and want to chase and surround myself with are reasonable people. It is an incredibly charged and divided time right now in America, but also increasingly in the world. And we desperately need more reasonable people in our societies. And here's what I think they look like. First, reasonable people have strong opinions that are deeply considered and respectfully conveyed. I don't think being a reasonable person is about being a flake. I think it is 100% about the way you approach a conversation, a topic, an issue. You can say almost anything as long as you say it in the right way, in the right tone. And I think reasonable people understand that. And I think their opinions that they have are deeply considered. They're held with a lot of conviction, but they're conveyed incredibly respectfully. The second thing, reasonable people don't vilify the other side. Let's talk about abortion. That sounds like a great way to blow up and lose half my listenership here, right? If you look at the landscape, at least in America, I think it is very disingenuous to say liberal people want to kill babies. They don't. Liberal people don't want to go out and murder babies. They just have a very strong and passionate belief that women's rights are very important and need to be protected. Conservatives are not out to destroy and dismantle women's rights because they hate women. Conservatives look at abortion as an issue of trying to protect an unborn baby. And anytime, you can do this for also when people say, anytime I hear someone says, the people on the left hate America and want it to burn down, or people on the right hate America and want to destroy it, that to me is a sign of someone who's deeply unreasonable. I think reasonable people are able to look at both sides of an issue. And even if they strongly disagree, they have friends on both sides, they can strongman the argument for the other side, and they understand the position. They just think that the end point, and oftentimes, which most ironic is a lot of times, not always, but oftentimes, the place that these people on different sides of the aisle are trying to get to, they're trying to get to the same place. They just differ strongly on how they're going to get there. So reasonable people do not vilify the other side, and they can strongman the position for them. Number three, reasonable people have good judgment. Have you ever met someone and within 60 seconds, you have become their personal therapist? They are unloading to you about all the problems in their life, their sister who has been flirting with their husband, and all these things that you just think, why are you telling me this? Or they start talking about political issues or sensitive issues in a way that's condescending to the other side, just assuming that you disagree with them. Reasonable people have judgment. They know when to hold back. They know when, you know, they're not going to unload on you out of the gates, but they also know how to tactfully, respectfully talk about meaningful things when the time and the rapport and the relationship is right. Number four, I think reasonable people are nuanced. They can see a lot of different sides. Reasonable people, I believe, have voted for someone outside of their primary party, if they're right or left, at least once in their life. Reasonable people can say something that a president that they didn't vote for has done well, at least one thing. And they can also offer a pretty sound critique of the president or the political candidate or the issue that they have voted for or they do support. I think Bill Maurer is a really impressive example of this. He's someone who just is able to, and in a very rare way in today's world, take issues from right, left, center, and put them together into his own unique viewpoints and worldview, as opposed to taking from basket A or B. And I really respect that. Even if I don't agree with him with anything, I think he does that really, really well. Finally, I think reasonable people are open to changing their mind and to listening. And not to say that you have to think that you're wrong. Again, reasonable people have incredibly strong opinions. Maybe you only think there is a 1% chance. I've talked to people who I love dearly that tell me that there is a 0% chance that aliens exist. And I just think not even a 1% chance, like the whole world, billions of stars, you won't even put it at 1%. And I think if you don't even keep open the tiniest threshold or possibility that you are wrong on an issue, then at that point, that's the point at where you stop becoming a dynamic, critically thinking person. Not to say, again, make the percentage as small as possible, but you always need, I think, to leave the possibility open that you're wrong. And I think that's the mark of someone who's very reasonable. Not to disappoint you, I'm sure I won't. I'm not going to get into overt politics on the show or in the forums. One of our big guiding principles in our community is no politics, because it often devolves and it doesn't go well, even among a bunch of really smart, fun, great, generally fantastic entrepreneurs. And I have very strong opinions on almost everything political, worldview, life, parenting. Come grab me at an event when you see me next time over a drink, and I'm happy to share in kind of a more appropriate environment. Not going to do that in this segment today or on the podcast. If you've followed along, you know that. But when I think about my friends, when I think about the people who I'm trying to deepen my relationships with, the people who influence me, the people I respect, the people that have the largest ability to shape my opinions and worldviews, it's not the people on the left, it's not the people on the right, it's not even the people in the middle. It's the people that are reasonable. If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.